This is a serious group, no formal breaks. It's actually my pleasure to introduce the next speaker. Jerry Lefkowitz was, when I started this, the deputy chair of the Public Employment Relations Board. He held that post from 1967 to 1986. After that, he was served as deputy counsel for CSEA for the last 20 years and now has returned to PIRB as its chair. As I said before, I'm a little bit humbled talking about the tail law around Jerry. He literally wrote the law. So, and actually a lot of management people, since he's worked for a union for the last 20 years, raised some issues about him being the next chair and how we're going to do. And I said, look, one of the things we have at least on our side is that he does have a history, and he really has probably greater history than anyone around. And I hope that the underlying premises of this act that were contained in the Taylor Committee still remain viable today, and we'll see how they're reflected in his upcoming decision. So it's my pleasure to introduce Jerry. I've known him, as I said, forever, and he's not only a colleague, but also I consider him a friend. Jerry Lefkowitz.
I guess I'm very pleased to be here. I've been very much impressed with the program thus far, and I hope that I can continue, at least in some measure, the quality of the very fine program that EJ has put together with others. I have a written report that should be out there for you to take, and in it I have discussed a number of the issues, detailed history of the Taylor Law, and in the context of the development of laws in other states as well. I will be touching on that a little in my remarks here, but I want to deal with the issues that have come up in the reports. I might start by telling you that the best word on the Taylor Law was delivered by Gilbert of Gilbert and Sullivan in Iolanthe. Of course, some of you may be cynical enough to think that Gilbert was being somewhat cynical, but I doubt it. The law is the true embodiment of everything that's excellent. It has no fault. It has no flaw. And I, my lords, embody the law. The enactment of laws granting constructive collective bargaining rights in the public sector has been condemned as being destructive of the power of public administrators to manage affairs of government and blamed for increasing costs. Unions, too, oppose these laws, and especially the Taylor Law, because they continue the common law prohibition against strikes by public employees. They have complained about the denial of the right of the strike in the public sector and that restrictions upon the scope of negotiations are too severe. However, the criticisms from both sides assume that these statutes have greater influence than they do. The laws were more an effect than a cause of social development. The primary function of the procedures was to provide a legal structure by which the inexorable process was fulfilled with a minimum of friction and anguish. I was called by Governor's Counsel, Counselor Governor Rockefeller, in January of 1966 during the subway strike and asked to meet with him and several other people to come up with an idea what could be done about this horrendous subway strike. How could they be prevented in the future? And perhaps what could tempt Michael Quayle to call off his current strike? Having recently drafted a bill under the same circumstances where a number of Catholic hospitals were being struck by a union in an organizing campaign, and having had that a law introduced that did accomplish those things, I suggested that you might well give the employees the right to organize and the right to bargain. I think that that would relieve strikes in the future, although much less likely to persuade Quill to call off the strike. This was immediately taken to the governor, who sent back word that he thought it a good idea. Please come tomorrow and draft the bill. This took place at about 2 a.m. At an all-night session. I came back the next day and was told, don't have to draft the bill, the strike settled during the early morning hours. However, the governor likes the idea. He can pass it on the suggestion or recommendation of Jerry Lefkowitz, but he was going to appoint a high-powered commission to come up with their suggestions, letting them know that this was a possibility, the Taylor Committee. The bill was passed, and I was then called in to draft the statute to conform to the recommendations of the Taylor Committee. Let me tell you what the law does more in my written report, but I'll touch on the highlights. First of all, you've got to decide what is the unit in which employees should be represented, and how do you determine representation by certification, by recognition, and things of that type. And the background is that in the private sector, you must first determine what an appropriate unit is. And that's sort of like an election district for assembly or senators. The key word was an appropriate unit. There are many possibilities of appropriate units. Everybody who works with this can be in an appropriate unit. Everybody in the same job title. Anybody in the same location. Anybody that has fairly comparable wage rates in advance. And in the private sector, this meant that a union could pretty much, and in any kind of unit that it petitioned for, it would be an appropriate unit. And the structure of collective bargaining was that units were created by the board or by the unions being recognized by employers to the extent of where they had organization. If you're organized in a small group, you get a small union. You're organized in another small group, you get that. Somebody else would get that. If you're organized in a very large unit, you get a big unit. Perb quickly developed the theory of most appropriate unit. It was helped by the statute because the statute had more than one standard, not just community of interest, but several other standards as well, one of which was the ability of unions and management to service the public. And harmonizing community of interest with the concept that this has to serve the public, Perb said, we have to create the most appropriate unit. And the most appropriate unit is the largest unit in which there is a community of interest. I would suggest that this was probably the most important decision that Perb met in terms of getting stable relationships in the public sector and has been of great benefit to the people of the state. Another issue with respect to representation is managerial employees, supervisors, confidential employees. Originally, the law said nothing about it. In the very first state case, the governor had recognized CSEA as the representative of all public employees in the state, other than the state police and the faculty of the state university, in one single unit. 36 unions filed petitions for different kind of units of all kinds of configurations. Eventually, Perb came up with its theory of 5, later 6 units that would cut across departments, cut across, involve multiple occupations, but just groups of unions, because it was concerned about stability. Had we granted some of the small units and rejected others in the first instance, we would have just handed a roadmap to unions, say, this is what you have to prove to carve somebody, some group out. And the bêtise before us was that New York City had 350 units, and it was a mess. The law, however, did not exclude supervisors. It was not part of the recommendation of the Taylor Committee, with good reason. Two good reasons. One, in New York City, large numbers of supervisors who in the 5 or 7 years before that there was collective bargaining had fallen way behind their bosses. The rank and file were organized. The managerial employees enjoyed mostly political protection. The supervisors had no support and fell behind in salary. People who worked for them were getting more money than supervisors because of overtime salary, overtime compensation. The other reason was that in the civil service, supervisors were getting benefits in proportion, direct ratio to what the rank and file employees were getting. They were getting the same vacation schedules, the same travel allowances and other things, and therefore they were not eligible for bonuses because they were not employees who were part of the management team. And therefore, that was done. Once you get the units and the unions, and you decide what the governments are, which was no easy task because of splits between legislatures and the legislative branches and executive branches, but these were worked out, you come to the task of bargaining. I discuss mediation and fact-finding in my written report, but I'll skip those. The issue before you and your concern is obviously arbitration. Interest arbitration, the arbitration as to what the contract should have been had the people been able to reach one. Interest arbitration, according to standards provided in the statute, requires compensation, comparisons and compensation and other benefits, the needs of employees, and expressly stated the ability of the public to pay, public employer to pay. I recognize that EJ wants that stressed. It's in the statute in so many words, and it is something that in a number of training sessions we have always expressed strongly to arbitrators who are being trained by us. I must confess that in the last number of years, PERB has not done this training, and maybe something has fallen, but it's something that we are in PERB considering resuming training, and a good part of the training would be emphasizing that. IP charges. There's a duty to bargain in good faith over terms and conditions of employment. Terms and conditions of employment is both something that you're entitled to and it's a limitation of what you're not entitled to. For example, if the employer, if the employees want to bargain about the mission of the organization, that's not a term and condition of employment. It's a limitation, and therefore it cannot be bargained. At one point, as you heard, pensions are bargainable. But pensions became not bargainable because employers would often try and evade or avoid paying big raises by saying, well, we'll give you a pension increase, because some mayor down the line would have to pay for that. That was the reason. When that happened, I urged the legislature not to pass that prohibition against pension negotiation. I suggested that instead they require all pensions to be totally 100% funded in each and every year. Then if the unions feel that pensions are more important than salaries, they can direct that. Management usually is concerned about the totality of the bill. My suggestion was not accepted, and within a couple of years, the unions, having gotten their compensation package from the employer, spoke to the comptroller and managed to get very big pension increases. Another improper practice, the tri-borough, is of interest and concern to you. And as we know, it is an explicit quid pro quo for not striking. Strikes were a very big problem in the early of the Taylor Law. It was anticipated by several professors who said, look, there's going to be an explosion of strikes because all of a sudden, hundreds of thousands of employees will be unionized who were not unionized. And they were right. Not long after the Triborough Amendment, and because of the Triborough Amendment and because of other factors, such as training of mediators, training and more qualified negotiators for both union and management, strikes have dropped off the table. Almost down now to about one a year on average. And all I can say is be careful of what you wish for. It works. And if you stop it, you may be getting more strikes. Among the be careful what you wish for, there are other cautions too. Probably the biggest explosion of employee benefits in the last 20, 25 years in negotiation has been in the negotiation of things that had been determined to be non-mandatory subjects of bargaining in the past. PERB, an employer urging, promulgated or issued its Cohoes decision, which made non-mandatory subjects of bargaining negotiable once put into a contract. This has led to an explosion of issues subject to bargaining. In the Kane Mutiny, Herman Wolk has one of his characters described Navy regulations as being formulated by geniuses to be administered by morons. The description may or may not have been accurate. If it was, the process may or may not have worked for the Navy. But clearly, it would not work for labor relations agencies. No matter how well-conceived and well-drafted, it may be that a collective bargaining law will fail if it is not administered fairly and effectively. Contrarywise, provisions of law or regulation that are manifestly inadequate can sustain an effective labor relations program if those provisions are administered fairly and with skill and imagination. There are various models for the board or commission or administering collective bargaining law. Each of these administrative structures has assets and liabilities. The differences between them are not critical. What is critical is that the agency be impartial regarding those matters that come before it for adjudication, that it have no pro-management or pro-labor bias as it conciliates negotiations disputes, and that its members and staff be competent. It is essential that the agency be independent of executive control and that be subject only to court review to assure compliance with the provisions of law. Despite criticisms by governments and unions, or perhaps as attested to by those mutually contradictory criticisms, I submit that the Taylor Law affords both groups as reasonably even a playing field as we are likely to fashion. Questions? If you have time.
Any questions for Mr. Lefkowitz? Could you go to the microphone, please?
Good day. I appreciate it. My name is Tony Massar. I'm from Binghamton, New York. I'm in City Council. I also have been involved in labor relations since 74. Both on management side of the table and labor side. The question that's always befuddled me, both on labor and management side, is dealing with the comparability aspect that's contained in the law and the reliance on comparability by way of your mediators and fact finders. Maybe about 15 years ago, I had one of the most unreasonable fact finders. Kevin, are you still here? Who I kept on berating the fact that comparability at that point in time meant nothing to the school district, because we're dealing with our own labor relations concerns and our own financial problems, and that what transpired in another district by way of the collective bargaining agreement was pretty much inherent to that district because of the fact that they, over a period of time, had put into their contract that which they needed, that which they wanted. It was a quid pro quo, and we had no deal, no saying in what they gave for what they got. So the question comes down to, why is comparability still around? Because we all know that that's a tennis game. In the brief, as a matter of fact, for fact finding, I put to Kevin, assuming arguendo that the fact finder will be utilizing comparability, I offer the following, and he came up with something that I still quote today, that the district representative, almost to the degree of fanaticism, states that comparability should not matter here. And I appreciated that greatly, Kevin. I really do. I use that quote today still. But the question comes down to, nowadays, should there be a reliance upon comparability given those factors?
Well, first of all, you're talking about fact-finding
And an interest arbitration as
interest
well.
Interest arbitration.
Certainly.
Okay, because comparability is a factor in comparability is a factor in interest arbitration. In fact-finding, anything that the fact-finder thinks is important, but it's
so
not
Kevin
binding
said.
In any event.
Indeed.
So we're talking about interest arbitration, and the legislature was trying to come up with concepts of things that a number of things that would be relevant. It seems to me that it's relevant if teachers all around the state are getting between of a certain group are getting between $35,000 and $45,000. Mm-hmm. I maybe. Remembering things from years ago, or I don't know, but if that's the case, the legislature is saying it would be inappropriate for you to award $20,000, or it would be inappropriate for you to award $75,000. It's a factor to be considered, among others.
But given the fact that, indeed, what transpires in some other city, municipal subdivision has nothing to do with the financial factors within perhaps my city, now that I'm in city council as well, and dealing with collective bargaining, that that criteria itself, maybe at one point in time in the beginning, may have been something to be relied upon. But given the fact that times have changed, finances have changed, in any particular municipal subdivision, that a reliance upon that mandated to have one of those criteria in law just seems anymore to be something that just shouldn't be around. Again, I can come up with a ton of figures on comparability, as well as labor can, and vice versa, and it's up to that third party as to which of those criteria
is
the best.
And I think that's what it is. This is something that that the law says you ought to take into consideration. It's really then something that lies with the arbitrator.
But wouldn't that then have a negative impact by way of the financial situation in a given municipal subdivision? Because we can only have control financially over what's in my city, for instance, or in the school districts that I negotiate for, but not in what's going on over there.
But the law also says that he should consider the ability to pay. And some people will say, why should we have to consider that? They're paying us minimum wage. They want to pay us minimum wage to be a teacher. And because they say they can't afford it, it's not right for anybody with a bachelor's or a master's to get it. You've got to be intelligent in the way that you handle it. It's adjudication. There are risks involved, obviously. However, you've got to take these risks. And basically, we trust adjudicators. It's a civilized way to resolve disputes. What do you want to do? You prefer strikes?
No.
That's the issue. If not, then you've got to trust adjudicators, and some are good, and some, but very few, make serious mistakes.
I appreciate it. Perhaps if we can make Kevin more reasonable as well, that would help.
Okay, well, we'll try and get him some training.
Thank you very much, Jerry.
Ooh.
Thanks. Thank you. Oh, that's mine.
That's yours. Okay.
All right, now we're ready for our break. Lunch is downstairs. If you go down the stairs to the second floor, there's a suite of very nice rooms. There's box lunches available there and different places to sit and or stand and have them. And I think if it's warm enough, also the very nice veranda. We come back up at 1 o'clock to hear our keynoter, Steve Levy, and we'll start wrestling you together in advance of that. So thank you very much, and enjoy your lunch.